For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So yes, it's very nice to be here. I am going to give a very relaxed talk. So I invite you to listen with very free and easy and forgiving ears. I've been thinking, well, that's too strong a verb. Animals have been on my mind, and specifically animals as they appear so often in our Zen literature. I mean, if you look at the table of contents of the Book of Serenity, you will meet cows, oxen, dogs, cats, monkeys, a rhinoceros. There are lots of animals there. And so I just, for some reason, was that came to my attention recently, and they were kind of on my mind. And when I was at Tassajara recently, I had the experience of, I came down, I was staying on this hillside, and I came down a little early one morning before the bell, you know, the wake-up bell, and I startled an animal in the kind of little roadway there, for those who know the place, that in discussing it with other people later, the consensus seemed to be that it must have been a bobcat. I mean, all I could see was the shadowy figure who, you know, saw me, and I saw these eyes, and then it's a very steep hillside, and this animal just, you know, just flashed across the road, this shadow, this mass, this black mass, and up this hillside. And the remarkable thing is, this is a very, very steep hillside. It's brush covered and unprovoked. You know, rocks are tumbling down all the time. But this animal just disappeared in this flash, and, you know, up the hillside, and I did not hear a bush, I did not hear a rock. It just, you know, this was an animal that was completely in its element, and did not want me to follow it with my eyes or otherwise. Very skillful. And it reminded me of a passage in Fukan Sa Zengi that will be sort of the launching place for my talk tonight, if all goes well. And I'll read it to you. So, Fukan Sa Zengi, this is Dogen's universally recommended instructions for Zazen. And in the middle of it, there's this one wonderful paragraph. It'll be familiar to many of you. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a breath and exhale fully. Rock your body right and left and settle into steady, immovable sitting. Think of not thinking. Not thinking? What kind of thinking is that? Beyond thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. And these are in this paragraph, these are the lines we usually talk about, and many of you will have heard Dharma talks on this idea of beyond thinking. But the paragraph continues. The Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the koan realized. Traps and snares can never reach it. If you grasp the point, you are like a dragon gaining the water, like a tiger taking to the mountains. For you must know that the true Dharma appears of itself, so that from the start, dullness and distraction are struck aside. And this image of the tiger and the dragon, I don't think I've ever really heard anybody talk about that, but they, for some reason, they're very powerful images for me. And they've always sort of attracted my attention, but I'd never really thought about it much. But they're such incredibly powerful images. And, you know, when I think of a dragon gaining the water, you have to understand that unlike the dragons in, say, Europe, the dragons on the eastern part of the Eurasian continent are less fire-breathing and more cloud-sailing and water-swimming creatures. I think we have one up here. And I always think of, when I think of, you can look at the dragon we have out here, I think of them as being kind of like otters with this super flexible spine. You know, if you've ever seen pictures of otters underwater, they can almost like, you know, they can, it makes them very agile. And I think of that kind of grace. And like a tiger taking to the mountains. I mean, okay, a tiger. Somehow, when I consciously entertain this image, you know, this idea of this tiger slipping away, it just seems like this thing of you know, what, grace, power, beauty, joy. You know, I mean, it's just this, these images are just this sort of like sense of, you know, back to where I belong, back to my true home, back to my element. And I don't know. It's I don't know what your associations are, but these came to mind precisely because I saw a little bit of this in this other animal. Just this animal really knew what it was about, really knew what it was doing, in a way that I never have. And you know, so. What's Dogen saying here? He seems to be saying explicitly that when we really connect with Zazen, that's the sense. It's a sense of easy. He calls it joyful ease. The sense of when we connect with it, he says we are like that tiger, we're like that dragon, and there's this sort of, you know, sense of release, being what you're supposed to be and where you're supposed to be and doing that right or something. And the implication here seems to be that the Zazen itself is the, you know, the tigers taking to the mountains and the dragon gaining the water. And you know, I often feel something like that. I mean, it wasn't immediate for me. It is for some people. I've met people who, the first time they sit down, there's that kind of connection. But over time of practice, I've come to realize, yes, there's something like that. The question is, where are we leaping from? Where are we slipping away from? And when we enter Zazen, what are we slipping into? And I'll just leave that as kind of an open question for the moment. And we'll come back to the tiger and the dragon later, and we'll come back to this idea of beyond thinking. You know, and I have this, you know, other association. Maybe somebody could quote the full poem. It's very short. I don't have it in mind, but I just thought of it on the way up here. There's this tiger, there's this poem in William Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience that begins, "Tiger, tiger, burning bright." Do people know this poem? And, you know, that too is so evocative. And it's like I ask myself, well, how, you know, I want to burn bright. I want to do that. You know, so maybe practice, maybe Zazen is a way to learn how to do that. Dogen is pretty dramatic. He's got all this very, very evocative, powerful language. Our more recent ancestor, Shogaku Shunryu, has a very different sort of feeling tone towards him. And, you know, he generates a different feeling than Dogen. And it's a much lower key, more, less dramatic. You know, he speaks in a different register. They're talking, they're talking about the same thing. It's, you know, the more you read them, you realize that's true. But I started thinking about this passage, and I started thinking, well, what about Suzuki Roshi? How does he talk? Well, you know, I thought immediately of the very famous cow in the large pasture. Many of you heard Dharma talks about that, so I won't go into that. But then I remember, no, there's some other things. I remember there was a cat and a frog in there somewhere. So I went looking through the through Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and found those passages, and I will read them to you. The first one is in a chapter called Bowing, it's really quite a wonderful chapter, and I'd recommend you read it if you have not for a while. But there's a passage in here about his own teacher, and that's what I would like to share with you. He says, "My teacher had a callus on his forehead from bowing." So they're referring to what we've just done, to the ground. "My teacher had a callus on his forehead from bowing. He knew he was an obstinate, stubborn fellow, and so he bowed and bowed and bowed. The reason he bowed was that inside himself, he always heard his master's scolding voice. He had joined the Soto order when he was 30, which for a Japanese priest is rather late. When we are young, we are less stubborn, and it is easier to get rid of our selfishness. So his master always called my teacher, 'You lately joined fellow,' and scolded him for joining so late. Actually, his master loved him for his stubborn character. When my teacher was 70, he said, 'When I was young, I was like a tiger, but now I'm like a cat.' And he was very pleased to be like a cat." That's kind of cool. That's kind of interesting. But what does he mean when he says he used to be a tiger and now he can happily tell us that he's like a cat? After a lifetime of practice, he's become like a cat. And I don't know. I mean, cats, if you know, they're quite tiger-like, actually. They're a little less... we have a closer relationship to them, and we can interact with them a little bit more easily than we can tigers, I think. But, you know, I asked myself, what is going on in that passage? Was the teacher... You know, he's using this image, but should we think that his nature was somehow transformed? He's become, through practice, a different species than he was, you know? That's one way of looking at it, and legitimate way of talking about it, because practice is obviously very transformative. But the other way to think about it is that through a life of practice, he actually came to know and appreciate and hold more dear what it had been his own nature all along. Not an animal that maybe would evoke fear, but one that could be, cuddled and then let out to do cat things. And I think maybe that's more like it. So I'll just leave that there for the moment. Then I thought about this passage. I knew there was a frog in the book somewhere. So I wanted to, instead of dragons and tigers, we have frogs and cats. So what is the frog doing? And I found that passage. And it is actually... turns out, I'd forgotten, introduces a koan that you'll be familiar with, many of you. And that's good because this koan actually lends itself very well to what I'd, at least a little bit of what I'd like to bring to your attention tonight. And this is in the chapter entitled Oh, I just lost my place. This is in the chapter entitled To Polish a Tile. So he starts, I'll read the introductory paragraph that introduces the frog. It says, Zen stories or koans are very difficult to understand before you know what we are doing moment after moment. But if you know exactly what we are doing in each moment, you will not find koans so difficult. There are so many koans. I often talk to you about a frog, and every time somebody laughs. But a frog is very interesting. He sits like us too, you know. But he does not think he is doing anything special. When you go to the Zendo and sit, you may think you are doing some special thing. While your husband or wife is sleeping, you are practicing Zazen! Exclamation point. You are doing some special thing and your spouse is lazy! Exclamation point. That may be your understanding of Zazen. But look at the frog. A frog also sits like us, but he has no idea of Zazen. Watch him. If something annoys him, he will make a face. If something comes along to eat, he will snap it up and eat. And he eats sitting. Actually, that is our Zazen, not any special thing. And then he says, here's a kind of frog koan for you. And the koan he talks about is nangaku, nanyue in Chinese, and baso or matsu together. Matsu, who became a very sort of very, very famous teacher in the sort of other, you know, surviving lineage of Zen that became the Rinzai. It's very well known. Nanyue, his teacher, was a student of the sixth patriarch, Wei Nung. But this is a story, and Nanyue, Matsu's teacher, came along, and Matsu was very, you know, diligently sitting. So Nanyue, you know, basically said, "Well, Matsu, what are you doing?" And you know, he says, I'm sitting. And he says, well, why are you sitting like that? And Matsu says, I want to become a Buddha. And Nanyue didn't say anything, but he sat down and picked up a piece of tile. You know, there's around the edges of Zen walls and stuff, there are always crumbled tiles. And picked up a piece of tile and started polishing it. And, you know, after a while, I guess Matsu loosened up a little bit. He probably sat there and, like, you know, was trying to, what's going on here? And finally said, what are you doing? Why are you polishing that tile? And the answer was, I'm polishing the tile to make a mirror. And, Matsu said, well, you can't polish a tile and get a mirror. And Nanyue said something like, well, you can't sit and become a Buddha. So that's there's an interesting story there. And, you know, there's much that can be said about it, but the, you know, one of the sort of clearest and most easily understood aspects of the story is to sit here and say, well, you know, he's not, it's not like Nanyue is saying you shouldn't do Zazen. He's just sort of saying you don't do Zazen to become a Buddha. In the same Pukan Zazengi, Dogen, in his instructions, one of the things he says is give up all designs on becoming a Buddha. You know, so, you know, an obvious connection between those two little Dharma tidbits is the verb become. And it's not that Nanyue or Dogen is saying, don't sit. It's I think he's asking us to reconsider what our sitting is. And it's, in fact, I think it's later in the same story where we get the expression, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. You know, it's this idea of well, fundamentally what it is, and you know, you'll find this if you look for it throughout the Zen stories, it's the idea you don't sit to become a Buddha. You sit because you have Buddha nature. You are expressing your own nature. And in doing so, you know, we may go from perceiving ourselves to be a tiger and start perceiving ourselves as a cat. And, you know, maybe we give up our grandiose ideas about being a dragon and realize, well, we're a frog, and that's fine. But the idea is that we don't, it's not to become a Buddha that we sit, but simply that we have that nature. And, you know, what Buddhas do is sit. It's not, you know, there's not a cause effect kind of thing here going on exactly. It's the idea, it's Dogen's idea of practice realization. I asked earlier this question of like, well, okay, Dogen is saying, you know, for us to enjoy the grace and ease and dignity and power and joy of being like a tiger slipping into the woods, or being like a dragon slipping into the water, we do zazen. But the question for me was like, well, yeah, but where are we leaping from? What is our situation? And you know, stepping back, you know, to the beginning part about the dragon and the tiger is like, you know, Dogen's just saying something about a tiger. He's just saying something about a dragon. He's not saying they're together. But somehow the image of that I've always had when I read that passage is like, okay, I am in some place with a dragon and a tiger, you know, and the tiger's doing its thing, and the dragon's doing its thing, and where do I slip into? Where do I find that joy, that bliss, and that ease? What is my realm? You know, I'm not a woods being. I'm not a water being. You know, and Dogen clearly doesn't mean anything so, you know, pedestrian, I don't think, as, you know, we're on land. So, you know, I think of myself, you know, on this, like, stream bank, you know, appropriately on this side of this shore, you know, to evoke that metaphor. And the dragon goes and the tiger goes, and it's like, what about me? What do I do? And then I remembered a passage in Genjo Koan, which I will read, also about animals. Dogen says, a fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there is no end to the water. A bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air. However, the fish and the bird have never left their elements. When their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. Thus, each of them totally covers its full range, and each of them totally experiences its realm. If a bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If a fish leaves the water, it will die at once. Know that the water is life and the air is life. The bird is life and the fish is life. Life must be the bird, and life must be the fish. It is possible to illustrate this with more analogies. Practice enlightenment and people are also like this. Now, if a bird or a fish tries to reach the end of its element before moving in it, this bird or fish will not find its way or its place. When you find your way or your place, the place where you are, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. When you find the way at this moment, practice occurs, actualizing the fundamental point. For the place, the way is neither large nor small, neither yours nor others. And it goes on. It says, practice enlightenment and people are also like this, like this, like this. It, you know, so, like what? It's like, you know, the water and the air in life, the water and the air must be life. Life must be a bird and the fish. The bird and the fish must be life. And, you know, so he seems to be saying, you know, you are also like this. You know, when you find your place, you will find that, you know, you must be life. Life must be you. You know, and so here we are. And this information is given that, you know, where does Zazen fit into this? I think that, you know, initially, I mean, for a long time, I understood this passage to be saying, well, you know, as water is to a bird, as water is to a fish, as air is to a bird, Zazen is to us. Zazen is our realm. Our proper human realm, if we can find it. But, you know, when I think about it, it's not quite, that doesn't quite add up, because I think that the Zazen is actually more like the swimming and like the flying. That's what we can do to find our realm and to come to know our place in it. And by doing so, enter the Dharma gate of bliss and repose that he's talking about. But what is our realm? You know, what is this that us critters who don't swim underwater and bound through the woods? How do we describe it? You know, sort of the doctrinal answer is that our realm is the saha loka, the realm of endurance. And it said that Sakyamuni, we have to endure because the Buddha realm of Sakyamuni is an impure realm. It's a troubled realm. And but endure what? Well, First Noble Truth, we endure all kinds of dukkha, all kinds of, you know, the ease and that the tiger has, ease and grace that the dragon has, is something that's problematic for us. Why? Because, you know, I'm sure you know, the dragon and the tiger and their lineage goes all the way back as ours does, you know, to some point where they were the same, no doubt. But somehow our karma is not only ancient, it got a little twisted. We cause ourselves problems and confusion and therefore we suffer. And so our realm is the realm of endurance. That endure, that the root of that is hard. So maybe there's a suggestion, you know, to live in the human world, you got to be tough. There may be an element of that, but there's a trick, you know, the trick is to how to be tough, durable, or whatever, without becoming hard. In other words, like tough, able to take what comes, but not give hardness back, you know, because what we're cultivating in Buddhist practice is ultimately wisdom and compassion. So our realm, we live in the Saha realm, suffering, you know, is that what's meant? Is that our realm? And is that what we come to know better and better? And work with more skillfully? Maybe that's part of it. Sometimes I think, well, maybe Dogen means language. I mean, that's one thing that human beings are so strong in, that we cause ourselves a good deal of confusion through it, that may distinguish us from other beings. So language, you know, is it language? And so I started to think about how we might think about working with suffering and with language, with the creation of meaning, all that stuff, you know. And then I flash back to this, the first part of this little passage from Dukang Zazengi that I read to you. Where the guys, this comes from another koan story, and you know, somebody says to somebody else, well, what do you think about when you're doing zazen? He says, thinking about not thinking. How do you think not thinking? And the guy says, beyond thinking. And maybe that's a way to think about, you know, suffering, or language or meaning, that we, how do we, what is our project? Or if our realm is suffering, our project is to suffer suffering. But, you know, in our practice, we, you know, it's explicitly sort of geared to overcoming, quote unquote, suffering. So how do we suffer our suffering skillfully by learning through practice not to suffer? And how do we practice not suffering? It's not suffering for us is not suffering. It's non-suffering. Clearly, the Buddha himself, you know, ate a piece of bad meat or a poison mushroom or whatever. He was sick for a long time, and then he died, right? It's not like anything about practice is going to, you know, remove the truth from those Four Noble Truths. You know, our lives will continue to have beginnings and ends, and a lot of trouble in between, a lot of joy in between. But we, those of us who are fortunate, will grow old. Those who grow old, and many others, will likely experience illness, and then we all die. So maybe practice is about, you know, practice being zazen, and the precepts is about learning non-suffering. You know, putting ourselves into a different register, and maybe if our realm is language and the snares and traps of language, maybe it's a matter of escaping the snares and traps of language through the creation of meaning, through instead inviting non-meaning, instead of inviting meaninglessness, to sort of invite some kind of non-meaning, where, you know, all those processes continue, but because we come to acknowledge and actually rejoice in the non-graspability of things, ultimately, we, as it said in the chant we did before, you know, we learn to walk innocently, you know, letting go of hundreds of years, relaxing completely. So I don't know. I think what it all adds up to is that, you know, we're human beings and we stay human beings, and this is a practice for human beings. One very good way to approach that situation is through the practice of Zazen. In doing so, you know, depending on what kind of language game we're playing at the time, we can talk about becoming Buddhas, and we can talk about changing ourselves from a tiger to a cat, or from a dragon into a frog, or vice versa. But, you know, when you get right down to it, is here we are, and here we will be, and here we will live and die, and you know, all the obstacles and hindrances to awakening are contained between the crown of my head and my toes. You know, that lump of red flesh that Rinzai talks about, and all the liberation is there. But it's a human, it's a human being. And, you know, Suzuki Roshi talks a lot about, you know, says things, when you become you, Buddha becomes Buddha. Or, you know, to realize Buddha nature is to realize your human nature. And so what's really being talked about in a way is finding a way to be not only a human being, but to be a human being, a humane human being, a, you know, kind and loving and insightful and wise human being, and practice. I don't know, you know, I don't, you know, I invite you to consider what our realm might be, but I think, you know, at least one possibility, and at this point in my life, the only possibility for me is the form that my leap into whatever grace and joy and ease and dignity I can express will be through Zazen. But not because Zazen's going to alleviate me of the pain. It's not because Zazen's going to leave Nyozan of the pain of being Eric Schutt. It's a matter of Eric Schutt, like, learning, you know, not even who, maybe, but what, you know, what is this, you know? So I don't know, that's, I'm sorry for the incoherence of that, but that's what I have to share tonight, and I've gone on a long time. I thank you for your patience, and there's a little time if people have any responses.
Mountains were mountains again. rivers with rivers. But true reality of them. And so I kept going back to that in my head as you were speaking, which is sort of, what is this? And what is the idea? What is the Dharma? What is the reality? Are they the same? Are they different?
Thank you. Yeah, that's, Hogetsu. No, I think that's actually a very apt association, I think. You know, and maybe part of that is that, you know, we start practice and, you know, we think that, you know, this is me, and I'm going to take me, and somehow I'm going to become Suzuki Roshi or Shakyamuni Buddha. And that, that's inspiring, right? It sets us in motion. But we come to find that, no, we're not going to be Shakyamuni, we're not going to be Suzuki Roshi, which is not to say we are not going to be Buddhas, but practice is the tiger joyously expressing his nature as a tiger, and the fish joyously expressing its nature as a fish, and Ben learning to like really know what it is to be Ben and Hogetsu and you and me and so on and so on.
Yeah, like Ben knowing what it is to be Hogetsu. Yeah. And what it is to be Buddha and what it is to be Kyosan, what it is to be before. I've been obsessed lately with this Netflix documentary called One Earth, I think, or Our Earth. Has anybody seen this thing?
David.
Yeah, David Attenborough, 97 year old David Attenborough. But I was struck by the vulnerability and tenderness of all life. And to me, it was this invitation to look at the kind of harmonious working of things and not working, you know, due to humans, like, mass quantities of species are gone. Like 90% of most things. You probably know this better than I do, we're all as naturalists, but, you know, one of my natural habitats is the ocean, and I've been swimming in coral reefs most of my life, and now they're like a graveyard, bleached and empty, but before they were breathtaking, in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And, you know, this documentary really looks at this situation, but also, you know, we're just like those animals. We're very vulnerable and tender, and you know, we maybe forget where our place is in the world. And I don't know why that is. You know, I don't. Maybe penguins don't really think about the places in the world. You know, they're just like doing the same thing we are. They probably kill off the rest of the planet if they get away with it.
But they can't.
But there's something about that vulnerability and also this kind of working together, this harmonizing. You know, it's not like, oh, I want this tiger's this graceful animal. The tiger's afraid.
Yeah.
The tiger's constantly scared it's not going to get enough food and it's on the prowl and, you know, out of its need, it kills without apparent compunction. You know, so I don't know, I think this is a great talk and the thought of our place in the world and who is it that thus comes.
I'll get to you just a second, but
it's you kind of spun it in a way that was really helpful for me, because what I was hearing in what Noza was talking about was unconditioned and conditioned. You know, the we can think about tigers as being a little bit wild and not having the same sort of layers of conditioning that and socialization that, you know, cats do and that we do. But it's true that a tiger, you know, is not something that we're trying to emulate either. They have clearly their own conditioning. But what we can do when we sit zazen is to really look at our conditioning and see how we have actually both kinds of conditioning. We have a socialization and that helps us think about, you know, what's good for us sort of collectively, and then what's, you know, and then we've got that solitary nature that's like, what do I want? What's good for just me? And I think sometimes practice can be a lot of finding that kind of freedom that allows us to slip into our situations, but it's by, you know, hours and hours and hours of examining our conditioning and deciding what we want to do about that, what is really, you know, letting go of our personal preferences so that we can really see the big picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think about, you know, what you're saying. Charlotte Joko Beck, you know, has this line, you know, my dog does not sit around worrying about the meaning of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the tiger, as you appropriately point out, is like the frog that Suzuki Roshi is talking about, you know, sees something to eat and eats it and probably gets eaten and, you know, at some point, as all of us do. And, you know, so that basic situation is there, but as I said, we've got this twist, and we take this situation and we try to add something, basically through separation, through rejection, that just kind of makes it worse. And I've been reading some of the fascicles in the so-called transmission fascicles in Dogen, and there's a way, I can't tell you the names, but there are two stories, I think one's from Hongren talking to Wei Nung, and then I think the other one is Wei Nung talking to Nanyue. I may be wrong about that, but, you know, in each case, you know, they say, I am like this, you are like this, and then again, another generation, I am like this, you are like this, and I think of that with what you say, because, you know, we think about the fish and, you know, this devastation that's going on, and not realizing that, you know, yes, you coral reef, yes, you monkey, you are like that, and I am like that, and we do something extra. And as a matter of fact, the literature, you know, says, you know, be like the frog, you know, eat when you're hungry, sleep when you're tired, and, I mean, it's hard for us to be that straightforward, but...
straightforward a lot of the times, but there's something that straightforwardness lacks kind of a deeper sense of harmony and compassion at times. You know, one of the things about living in a place like Tosapara or Zen Center, where they do things like somebody in the field accidentally puts a hoe into a rat or a rabbit, they take it to the altar. They don't kill it. They take this dying creature and they sit with it until it dies. You know, that there's a sense of somehow participating in this communion with all beings. And, you know, it's I guess I worry a little bit when what you were talking about, Nozan, about it feels sometimes there's this glorification of nature. Mm-hmm. And that feels like it ends up being a separation.
Yeah, because it's an idealization. It's a reification.
And there's some sense of, like, you know, we too are animals. I think if Richard Attenborough was watching us, he'd be narrating, you know, this is how Pogetsu arranges her robes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Floating around. Having her fellow Sansa people.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah.
I think that's where we're just wrapping around the world.
But sometimes eating when we're hungry and sleeping when we're tired is okay, but sometimes it's not okay. You know, and I think that's what we're looking at too.
Yeah.
That we can't take just one strategy. You can't just be a tired. And can't just be cats maybe have it because they didn't get as socialized as we did and as socialized as dogs did.
Yeah.
And they're not as wild as tigers, but we feed them anyway, so maybe
I think they're just smaller than tigers, you know. What's your name again?
Ken.
Ken, good to see you again.
During your talk, I think you were talking about I was talking with a friend the other day about the fleeting nature of Dharma moments, right? Like, there's a truth in, like, oh, isn't the tiger beautiful and the way it behaves? And then also, I don't remember what it was like to be a tiger or what it would be like to be a tiger, and maybe tigers have other problems. Or, like, when you were talking about maybe talking, like, words are difficult, right? Maybe that's what is part of it. Then I was thinking about what it was like as a human, and I don't remember it, but I've seen other humans that are pretty vocal, right? And then I'm just imagining this planet running around where none of us could talk to each other, and that also seemed awful, right? So yeah. Like, I'm just like the fleeting nature of, and my friend and I were talking about kind of the Four Noble Truths, and he's like, yeah, but life is suffering. I'm like, oh my gosh, if you're stuck at truth number two and just hang out there, that's an awful place to be. Or like in the Diamond Sutra, like, I got really nihilistic these past couple of years where I'm like, nothing's nothing. Like, it's all nothing, right? And so, like, why does it matter? So, like, I feel like there's this, there's so many sutras where it's like, you know, the burst of a bubble or whatever, all these different ways. But I was thinking about that bobcat that you saw, and I just was thinking, I wonder what the bobcat's like, right? Does it experience suffering as well?
I don't know. It, you know, I'm sure it experiences hunger and fear. I think it was probably, there was an element of fear on its encounter with me on both our parts. You know, but I don't know what to say. I think we take a situation, as human beings, we have this propensity to take challenging situations and then befuddle ourselves about the nature of those situations and act unskillfully in such ways that we increase our own suffering and the suffering of others. You know, just a very probably clumsy kind of thing. We take that moment of sort of alarm at seeing the shadow of a bobcat and then like spend the next 40 years walking down the same sets of stairs worrying about bobcats. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, anyway, it's getting late. We've got time for a couple more, then we should stop.
Yeah. The whole discussion about all the questions that have been raised to me made me think of the idea that intimacy is not knowing. And all the things that come with intimacy, like frustration and insecurity, but also compassion and curiosity. And I think everything that we've talked about, like, to me, you know, about the bobcat or, like, you know, the tiger, and, like, all those things make me feel intimate with all those things. And at once, you know, I feel insecure about, you know, maybe I don't know as much about those things, but also I feel compassion for all those things.
Thank you. Yeah, how do we learn to burn brightly? We know the world is burning in more ways than one. So, you know, how can we burn brightly, compassionately, and wisely? Maybe that's a place to stop.